Thank you, Tom. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to The Way of Truth. My name is Kenny Chumley, the preacher for the Gibson City Church of Christ, and it is indeed a pleasure to stand with you here on the threshold of a new year and to welcome you to The Way of Truth. We've been talking about the truth of Christianity, and we're going to continue that discussion this morning, but before we do, let me remind you, and if you're a regular listener, you'll know all this, but let me remind you that the Church of Christ in Gibson meets every Sunday for worship at 9 o'clock at its building on the south side of town. The church building is right on Route 47. We're the first building north of what used to be the Pizza Hut. At 9 o'clock, we assemble for worship, and on Wednesdays at 7 o'clock, we have a midweek Bible study. It lasts for an hour. We have classes for all ages at this midweek study. And we have a website. And if you'll go to GibsonCityChurchOfChrist.com, you can find all kinds of information about us. You can access audio files of these studies on the radio, of the sermons. You can see our Sunday bulletin. You can find out more about our beliefs. And that's all to be had by going to GibsonCityChurchOfChrist.com. We've been talking for the past few weeks about the truth of Christianity, and I've tried to point out that to determine if Christianity is true or not, we have to take a look at the documents that contain the story of Christianity. The story of Jesus is primarily told in four books that we know as Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And as I've discussed, as I've argued, there is more evidence for the veracity and reliability of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John than for any other book from antiquity. There is greater reason to believe the historical truthfulness of the Gospels than to believe Herodotus, who was called the father of history, or to believe Josephus, the great Jewish historian, or to believe Plato, or to believe Caesar's Gallic Wars, the account of his exploits in France. There's more reason to believe the Gospels than to believe any of those other historians. And yet, these other historians are all accepted as writing true history. And you can go to school and you can study them and you can come away with an understanding, with information about the history of their times. Well, if we're going to accept them as true, accurate historians, we have an even more reason for accepting the Gospels as a true historical account of the life of Jesus Christ. Now, the story they tell us is that there was a man known as Jesus of Nazareth, who was born in the city of Bethlehem, raised in the Galilean town of Nazareth, and for the last 3 years of his life, spent his time traversing Judea and claiming some spectacular, stupendous things. I'll talk about them in just a minute. But the proof that he offered, the ultimate proof he offered to substantiate all of his claims, is that 3 days after he died, he would be raised from the dead. There were things, miracles that he performed that, of course, substantiated his claims, but the ultimate miracle was going to be the resurrection. Now, as we've discussed, every valid historian, I mean, you'd have to be insane. There'd have to be something wrong with you to doubt this. Every valid historian admits that Jesus lived, that he was an actual historical person. And everyone who's taken the time to look into the evidence admits, and this goes not just for the friends of Jesus, but for his enemies as well, they admit that 3 days after he was killed, after he was executed and buried, 3 days later, the tomb in which he was buried was empty. And that begs the question, how did the tomb of Jesus come to be empty? And there's only two ways by which that could have happened. Either it was emptied naturally, or it was emptied supernaturally. The past couple of weeks, we've been looking at some of the natural explanations for the empty tomb. The hallucination theory, the wrong tomb theory, the stolen body theory, which was the first explanation for the empty tomb, the swoon theory. And I probably talked more about the stolen body theory than any other because that was the theory, the hypothesis that was offered in the very time of Christ by his enemies. Matthew chapter 28 tells us about that, and that theory hung around for a long time. But when we examined that theory against the evidence, we found that there's no evidence to support it. In fact, that theory is against the evidence. We talked about how that the disciples had neither motive nor means to steal the body of Jesus. And so the natural theories don't explain. William Lane Craig has done a great deal of debating about the existence of God. He is a believer who is an apologist who defends the existence of God in his writing and in his speaking. And he had a debate that was moderated by William F. Buckley, Jr. He had a debate with an individual by the name of John Dominic Crossan. And Crossan's not a believer in any biblical sense whatsoever. And Craig asked this man the question that sometimes needs to be asked people. The question he asked was, what would it take to convince you that Jesus rose from the dead? What kind of evidence would it take? And Crossan, interestingly, admitted that he had a theological presupposition against the resurrection. He had a presupposition against miracles. He had a position that wasn't based on the evidence. He had a position that he assumed, that he adopted, for who knows what reason. Who knows why. But he assumed it. And he said in this debate that he just didn't believe that God would work miracles. You know, suppositions are powerful things. I heard once about a man who became convinced that he was dead, and he went around telling his friends that he was dead, and finally one of his friends got a bit aggravated at this nonsense, and he told the man who thought he was dead, he said, "You know, dead men don't bleed." And after saying that, he grabbed the man's finger, pulled out a needle and pricked the tip of his finger, and a little bit of blood came out on the tip of his finger. And so he asked the fellow, he said, well, you're bleeding. What does that tell you? And the man who thought he was dead said, well, apparently dead men do bleed. You know, that man was going to do anything but give up his irrational presupposition. And there are people like that. There are people who have adopted conclusions, they have adopted worldviews that are completely independent from fact, that are completely independent from any evidence. And they are going to hold to those views no matter what the facts say. You've heard that expression, my mind's made up, don't confuse me with the facts. Well, there are people who are like that. The natural explanations for the empty tomb of Jesus do not explain. The only rational conclusion that can be drawn as to why the tomb was emptied the third day is that it was emptied through supernatural means, which means it was empty because Christ rose from the dead. And we don't have to reach that conclusion merely on the basis of circumstantial evidence, merely on the basis that we have ruled out all of the natural explanations. Sherlock Holmes one time explained to Watson that when you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, is the answer. Well, it's impossible that the natural explanations can explain the empty tomb, which leaves us only with a supernatural explanation, but we can do better than that. Because there is eyewitness testimony of people who said they saw Jesus alive after he was dead. When a case goes to court, when there's a trial, the very best kind of evidence that can be offered is eyewitness testimony. When you can put someone on the stand who can turn to the jury and say, I know that man sitting over there by the defense attorney is a murderer because I saw him pull the trigger that killed so-and-so. There is no higher evidence that can be offered in a court of law than eyewitness testimony. And we have abundant eyewitness testimony to the resurrection of Jesus. The apostles, of course, were the primary witnesses to Christ. And as I have talked about, they had no motive to make up a story that wasn't true. They had no motive to go around telling people that Christ had been raised from the dead when in fact he wasn't raised from the dead. As Paul explains in 1 Corinthians 4 and as we can find out elsewhere in the New Testament, the apostles were persecuted. Some of them were put to death. Nearly all of them, in fact, were put to death for preaching that Christ was resurrected. And yet, even when threatened with the third degree, they did not recant their testimony. If you want to get the truth out of somebody, threaten him. Threaten him with bodily harm. Persecute him. I have a cousin who lives down in Texas, and I can remember when I was a kid. One day he came in and told his stepfather he had been down the railroad tracks and had seen a bear. And at the time, his stepfather was trying to charge a car battery. Had a dead battery in the car, and so he had a charger hooked up to it. And when my cousin Alan told his stepfather that he had seen a bear down the railroad tracks, now this was in Rantoul, understand. When he had seen a bear down the railroad tracks, my stepfather took those jumper cables off the battery and clacked them together, and sparks just flew everywhere. And the stepfather said to my cousin Alan, "Alan, this is a lie detector. These cables are a lie detector. And I'm going to fasten them on your belt. And I'm going to ask you if you really saw a bear down the railroad tracks. And if you tell a lie, this lie detector is going to blow your brains out." Now that's what the stepfather told my cousin Alan. And so he hooked one of those jumper cables onto Alan's belt. And he says, "Now, Alan, did you see a bear down the railroad tracks?" And Alan's answer was, "Not to the best of my recollection." I mean, the third degree, the threat of bodily harm, of violence to one, can make a person tell the truth. The apostles were persecuted. They were put to death, but they did not recant their testimony. And they were men of integrity. I mean, they wrote the book on integrity, the New Testament. Can you imagine someone writing a book that sets forth the highest standard of integrity and morality that's known to man, and that book is based on a lie that they themselves had come up with? And they had plenty of opportunity to validate, to verify what they thought they saw. They thought they saw Jesus alive, and they were able to verify what they thought they saw over a 40-day period when they saw Christ under all kinds of circumstances, all kinds of situations, outside, inside, night, day, around a campfire, walking down the road. They were able to verify that this one they thought was Jesus was in fact really Jesus. And they had the mental capacity for determining if Christ was raised from the dead. I bet everybody listening to me today would be able to tell if a dead relative suddenly came back to life. I mean, we have that ability. We may not be a PhD, but certainly, surely we can tell if somebody who's dead has come back to life. And then we have the corroborating evidence of the greatest enemy of Christianity in the first century. He was a Jew by the name of Saul of Tarsus. And suddenly, without warning, this opponent, this foe of Christianity, became a believer and spent the rest of his life preaching that Jesus was raised from the dead because, he said, he saw him. He saw the resurrected Jesus. Can you imagine the chief Ayatollah in the Muslim world suddenly becoming a Christian? I mean, the shock that would set in over something like that was the kind of shock that set in over the conversion of Saul of Tarsus. And so the only explanation that explains the empty tomb is that Christ was raised. We have extraordinary testimony to that effect. We've got the number one enemy of Christ, Saul of Tarsus, saying, yes, he was raised from the dead. So next week, we'll start wrapping up this discussion of the truth of Christianity. I appreciate you for being with us today. I hope you come back next Sunday, and I hope this first week in the new year that God has given us will be a good one for you. I look forward to being with you again next week at 8 o'clock, right here on The Way of Truth.